welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and my guest today is author Steve Lundeen. He has just published his debut historical fiction, Shooting an Albatross. So Stephen lives in Hillsboro, Oregon. 2009 marks his fourth year of writing every day from 4 in the morning until he leaves to go to work as marketing director, vice president, and co-owner of a foundation engineering company. He holds an MBA, actuarial enrollment with both the Department of Labor and Department of Treasury, and recently completed his second novel, a sequel in his epic Albatross series. In 2006, Stephen began his writing career by sending a series of email writings that he used as a means to learn and practice the art of writing, as well as develop a subconscious awareness of readers. He wrote 66 email writings, over 10 short stories, and 2 full-length novels. His first short story actually won first place in a 2007 Author Link short story contest. And all of this was in earnest preparation for writing his first published novel, which he is here today to talk about. So you can find out more about Stephen and his book at shootinganalbatross.com. So that said, thank you so much for joining us today, Stephen.
Hi, Juanita. Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Oh, you're so welcome. I am really interested to hear more about this career transition that now has you up at 4 in the morning and writing at breakneck speed. So what happened?
Juanita, I got an illness several years ago, and I live with this illness, and I'm having a wonderful life in my career, my day job, I guess. And it occurred to me that, boy, I either begin writing, which I claim is a passion of my heart I'm going to someday do, or someday I don't do it. So I just made the decision I'm going to start writing and started writing every day, and I just haven't quit yet.
Isn't that amazing how a medical diagnosis, I mean, you really can take that in so many directions in your life, and it looks like, or it sounds like you're really turning this into a positive.
Well, you know, the illness could have been an excuse not to write. Instead, it's a reason to write. And if you look at it that way, boy, it just gives you enough incentive to write every single day. 4 in the morning's hard to get up that early.
Oh, gosh, I can't even imagine.
Sundays, holidays, 6 days, you pick a day and you do it. I did it every day in 2006, every day in 2007. I missed a couple days in 2008 when I had a cold, but
Oh, gosh. It
becomes who you are, I guess.
Right. Well, if it's your passion, it's not like it's work and you want to do it. So how many hours in a day are you actually devoting?
To writing, mm-hmm. You know, the morning is the morning.
Yeah.
4 a.m. You just pick that time. The problem I had is I started getting excited about my novel, when I first switched to writing a novel, boy, I'd start getting up at like 3:30, and I couldn't help it. I'd beat the alarm, and it's frustrating. And then I'd sort of cheat at the back end. My kids would come tramping downstairs, and life would start, and I'd just kind of ignore them, tune them off for a couple extra hours. And then all of a sudden, Saturday, Sunday, every day, I just wanted to write. And boy, I had to pull back because I realized there are things when you're writing that you don't know. What you don't know is that the writing changes who you are and the type of person you are. You start looking at the world differently, seeing things differently, and boy, you have to pull yourself back.
And I imagine writing fiction as well. Well, how did you see yourself changing?
Boy, I saw myself changing every way possible. I bought a camera. Started taking pictures of flowers on my little 2-acre plot, and I'm going, pictures of flowers, why would I do that? I started staring at people, watching for their character to appear in the way they moved. I had an interesting experience. It occurred at my doctor's office. Very important medical doctor is telling me these incredibly important things I'm supposed to be listening to. My wife is listening to him at the time, and he's looking at her. And I didn't hear a word he said. I sat there and watched his movement of his fingers, the skin as it moved over his cheekbones, the way he breathed. I tried to watch everything and see where he I was looking for his character.
Mm.
And the two started interrupted me at some point. Apparently, I wasn't listening to
you. You were dozing off, trailing off somewhere. That's so interesting that you're observing the world in a very different way now.
Yeah, it's a very teeny tiny look. As Tolstoy called it, the world of writing, the itty bitty. That translation is terrible for the word, but it was observing just the tiny, minute details of people, and boy, that sure comes true. My goodness.
So you had to take a step back.
Yeah, I had to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. That's why, boy, I say one of the biggest lessons I've learned from this experience of writing so intently is that a writer needs to stay engaged in life.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the day job was so important. I'd come into my day job and I couldn't focus on anything but the engineering and construction firm we have here, and there's no room for somebody to be thinking about something other than real life.
Right. It keeps you very focused. It's very left brain.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I had a problem at work at first. I had to make a rule. No talking about writing at work. Because normally I'm a very sober, quiet, contemplative person. Boy, but if you ask me about writing, criminy, I could ramble on for 8 hours. And that's why I put a rule in the company. Nobody says a word about writing.
Right, work's got to be done at work.
Yeah, no writing at work.
Oh, that's so interesting. So tell me, before you really decided to devote all this time to writing, where did this passion begin? You obviously have been, you've had a dream to write before this.
Yes, and it was one of those someday things, you know, when you're 90, you go, I never did do it.
Yeah.
When I was in college, a friend of mine, somehow turned me on to literature, and I just started reading and reading and reading and reading. Then when I hit, gosh, 10 years after that, I passed actuarial enrollment. I became an actuary, an ERISA actuary. It was a huge deal to me. My wife celebrated by buying me something I'd been wanting for years, this Easton Press collection of the 100 greatest books ever written.
Mm.
And I read not every one of them because I didn't include poetry as a book.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I do now. You know, I read Gustav Flaubert's Madame Bovary on Port of Vallarta on vacation, sitting on the beach under a palapa.
Oh, my gosh.
I've read all these books. You know, some of them are just unbelievably great, and I got the idea. Maybe everybody does that. I want to write a book like that and have it on my shelf and that I can sober myself and say, yeah, it belongs there.
Mm.
I haven't done it yet. This book is just an outstanding book that I've written in my mind, but I don't think it's going to be leather-bound, archival quality paper with gold trim on it sitting on my shelf.
Not your first book?
Yeah, I don't even think the second will, but maybe
the third.
No, not the third either. I'm looking.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the goal. I know where the end point is. I can see it, but I'm not there yet.
Good for you. Well, I think that's very realistic, and I think as long as you hold on to that vision, it will happen. Yes, absolutely. So with you being such a voracious reader then, what is important to you in a good book?
First and foremost, I think from a practical point of view, interesting. You know, something that truly interests you, someone, and is compelling, has them flipping the next page, and reading a story. I don't care what the story is, science fiction, you know, children's fiction, whatever it is. Make it so it's entertaining.
Mm.
Make it so people will read it. And once they're entertained and they're reading, boy, then you have so much room to deliver the message, themes that you put into your work.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even realize that it's there.
It's not forced.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So for you, are the themes the most important aspect of your writing? You know, some authors, they really are into the character development. What kind of a writer are you?
That is a really good question. Thank you, Juanita.
Mm-hmm.
It's one I've not considered.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I am a person who wants to write. And when I say that, character development does intrigue me. being able to put into words, you know, actually make people see the words or write a movie in effect. I want to be able to do that too, but those are ancillary. I think truly I get caught up in the cadence of the sound of the words. So suddenly maybe poetry is part of writing.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. I've got all this mixed up, paragraphs, sentences, shorter, longer, you know, cumulative sentences. It's still confusing in my mind and being discovered by me, and that's why I'm so anxious to keep writing. It's because I want to get and discover what I haven't yet discovered. The character development is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
What shocked me most is after I was well into my second novel, the sequel to Shooting an Albatross, I looked at the first novel and went, oh my goodness, there is a theme developing in these two about men who, or young men, I guess, who, what are they like if they grow up without a father?
Mm-hmm.
And they lose their father before they're even born, so they never even knew him, and there's no father-in-law involved. I got caught up in how those young men become men,
mm-hmm.
older men, and
mm-hmm.
when they're on, not the aggressive, I'm going to be macho and emulate the world's macho-type mentality, but rather are thoughtful, considerate. Are they watchful? I'm still trying to discover all of those traits of those men, but I find that boy, they sure are. There's a group that want to be fit in society, do the right thing, excel, achieve, and just be wonderful. But I watch them take tentative steps at first, and that is sort of the development and that I saw when I started really, truly looking and watching and writing, developing my main character in my first novel.
And that's Evan.
Evan Wilkins, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very, very interesting character. I'm wondering where this idea that you came up with, the theme in this book about the men that grow up without a father, and how that whole idea sort of formulated to put itself in this first book of yours.
I think the answer to that question, I'd sound real obvious, you know, clearly, you know, experience. People
mm-hmm.
write about what they know,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I, of course, I don't think I, no, I met my father one time when I was about 23 or 4 or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never focused on that absence in my life, if that's what I can call it,
mm-hmm.
Because I was living my life. It's only as an older gentleman now, as opposed to being a younger man, a younger kid, you don't think about those type
no.
things because you're too busy thinking about where you fit in or aligning yourself, I guess, with everybody else, finding your place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't see what really you're doing. And it's only when you're older and you look back, oh, there is a pattern here.
And probably when you have your own family.
Correct.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I see that now, and I'm watching, oh, my poor son, he doesn't know how much I stare at him.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I have a new trick. I actually put my finger over my lips when I watch people because that cues me to shut my mouth.
To keep your mouth closed.
Yeah, and I don't say a word. And if I have my finger on my lips, I am staring and recording everything I see, and I'm not going to say a darn word.
Interesting. Okay, so tell us a little then about the whole historical content that's found in Shooting an Albatross, because you've mixed some very interesting aspects now that I'm understanding of your own personal experience sort of thrown into this historical content, and then these characters, these very, very interesting characters. So first, let's talk about the reality, the historical connection.
Okay, I will. Backing up to my history,
mm-hmm.
which isn't that far, I began my career as an ERISA actuary. And an actuary is a man who wears a suit and tie, and I was buzzing all over the country, playing golf constantly. As a young kid, you're just a dummy. I take that back. I'm talking about me.
Just you, okay.
But I played golf all the time. Everybody wants, well, let's play around the golf. You know, all these older men, and I'm trying to fit into this society. And then, so I played golf like crazy. I got this illness. I couldn't golf any longer.
Mm-hmm.
I lived by a golf course. That doesn't make me an expert on anything other than I like to sit in my swing and watch golfers sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a family next door to me that is my wife's family. There is a 97-year-old man, 96-year-old woman, 93-year-old woman, 92-year-old woman.
Wow.
Four nanogenarians.
What a community.
One of these, the gentleman who's 97, was in the World War II. He was in the 170th Field Artillery Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulls out for me, gosh, he was 94 at the time, a pamphlet he was given from. It's a governmental pamphlet, a history of his battalion. As I'm flipping through it and reading it one day, I see that, my goodness, they stopped and took over the Ojai, California Country Club. And I went, Ojai Country Club, that's where the Bionic Woman, the show from, she was from Ojai, with Lindsay Wagner, I believe it is. Anyway, I flipped the next page, and look, they took over our golf course? No way. And so I went back to this gentleman, talked to him about that experience, and he made it sound so intriguing, told me stories about an Army general who showed up and was just madder than anything,
uh-huh.
that these kids basically parked all their artillery equipment all over this golf course. And the story started developing there. I discovered that 1943, the same year that the Army took over this golf course, 1943 was also the year, the only year in history, professional golf canceled the entire series or the entire season. So golf was canceled.
Why was it canceled?
Because of the war.
Oh, okay.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Stephen Lundeen. He is the author of Shooting an Albatross, and you can find out more about Stephen and his books at ShootingAnAlbatross.com.
I'm no historian of the war, but I do know that 1943 was a very significant, wildly dangerous year, violent year. It was sort of the beginning of the transition to the downfall of Germany,
mm-hmm.
in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's no golf that year. You've got the Army on this golf course, and it turns out that I discovered that an albatross, rather than being just a bird or some burden on your back, you've got an albatross on your back. Turns out also to be the name of a double eagle. So it was par, birdie, eagle, double eagle. That's called an albatross.
Okay.
So something gets shot. I write this novel. There are mansions along the backside of this golf course that belong to Hollywood film industry moguls at the time, one of whom has a daughter, Amanda Nichols, who Evan meets while he's at the golf course, and she starts secretly joining his golf practices on the golf course, and they establish a relationship. And I sought to develop one of those wartime relationships, you know, just stays in the mind forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have if it wasn't for Evan's commanding officer, Floyd Ackerley. So we've got conflict, we've got protagonist and antagonist, we've got a relationship going on, and we've got this theme of the Evan being growing into somebody who went from not benefiting from having a father to somebody that is capable of being one.
Mm.
And it just goes from there.
Quite a journey, and you know, it's such a layered story, and you actually start out here with with a man in his 60s hunting an older man who's in his 90s, and one of these men is Floyd Ackerley. What can you tell us about that? I mean, there's a real strong edge to your story as well.
Floyd Ackerley at 94, he surprised to 94.
Mm-hmm.
Floyd was 26 at the time Evan was at the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
Floyd was Evan Wilkins' commanding officer.
Mm-hmm.
And through a series of events that are told during the course of this novel, which takes place mostly back when Evan was alive and Floyd was a younger man, we realize that this Floyd, we see him transition from a sane second lieutenant all the way down to, he falls down basically through his actions, to basically a psychopath, somebody dangerous, somebody out of control, somebody who is actually quite frightening, and also somebody who survives till he's 94.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so how critical is Amanda to this whole, to the whole story and the whole overall vision that you had for the message of this book?
Oh, Amanda is just so important. She is, you put in this situation, you've got Army right there on the golf course. You've got her as this, it's like having a bouquet of flowers, you know, in this desolate desert. She is just such a innocent, wonderful, kind, neat person. And she is the reason there becomes jealousy between Floyd, the commanding officer, and Evan, the private. And through a series of events, we use Amanda to get Floyd antagonizing. Antagonists are supposed to antag, and boy, Floyd sure antags.
He does.
He does, but Evan is just this very gentle gentleman, in effect, and he is a golfer. The golf tournament that is set up, it builds up the entire novel. The Army showed up on July 26, 1943. They showed up on that golf course. The game of golf gets played August 31st. It's an Army-Navy golf game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Army leaves on September 3rd of 1943. So you see, it's just a little over a month.
Yeah.
And during that period, Amanda is the relief to some of the stress that's building up. And then the day the Army leaves the golf course, she's no longer part of the story other than somebody that we never get to really see.
Okay. So she is there, but I understand what you're saying. Interesting character.
Now, I wrote this novel in three parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a golf game. You tee off at the beginning. The first section is called The Tee. And that basically sets up the historical background of the scene, gets things moving. The second section is called the fairway. You're playing down the fairway after you tee off. And that section is more of a building of a relationship between Evan and Amanda, setting the stage for the conflict. And then the last section, if you're playing golf, you get up on the green, you hit it into the cup. I call that last section the hole, because that is what, in effect, the whole novel turns toward going down a hole. It becomes more of a psychological thriller in that last section.
Mm-hmm. Such an interesting mix. So where will you be going with the sequel at Legacy Management?
Legacy Management Inc. is the name of a company, and that company specializes in managing legacies. For instance, the Lizzie Borden family, we all know who that is, I believe. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. A horrible story.
Right.
But because the Borden hired Legacy Management Inc., the Borden family now is known for Borden Books instead of Lizzie's chopping up stuff.
Okay.
What that is a company that is directly going back to Evan Wilkins and trying to build, from shooting an albatross, trying to build a legacy, resurrect a legacy for this Nichols family that gets established.
It's
a company, but really the company is run by a man, the older man at the end of our story of shooting an albatross is Richard Nichols, and it's Richard Nichols trying to restore the legacy of his family.
Okay, so it there won't be recurring characters. It's a very different time that you're having the sequel.
Right, right. Very high speed. You know, there are things. I think it might have been D.H. Lawrence said, "No tears for the reader, no tears for the writer." I'm not crying. But I did find that when I wrote that book, gosh, I just couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
As a writer, I could. It's one of those, you start turning pages and, oh my goodness, it goes so darn fast. This first novel, Shooting an Albatross, does not have the 100-mile-an-hour pace.
Mm-hmm.
It gets there. You reach a point where you, boy, from what I've been told, I've had maybe, gosh, my group of readers is about 23. They claim, gosh, if you don't have everything out of your life by the time you get to this part in the second section, you're going to run into problems because you won't put the book down.
Oh, God, that's so funny.
The beginning of the book, you're trying to get into the historical environment, the character is the beginning. Boy, but once you're in it, it just takes off.
You're really in it. Well, you obviously write with so much excitement. It's, from what it sounds like, how are you tempering this enthusiasm and not sort of going overboard in your writing, which is really easy to do? I mean, that's one great thing about the editing process. But what do you keep in mind when you're writing?
I keep in mind that somebody's going to be reading. I think that is most important. You know, I keep a daily blog now.
I read a little bit of that, and I was going to make mention of that with all the quotes that you're dropping in this interview, and that's what I saw in your blog, so didn't mean to interrupt, but it's fantastic.
Okay. I use the word they, T-H-E-Y,
mm-hmm.
They are people in the book business. I'm not a book business person. I want to write. They are telling me, you should keep a blog.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in this down period right now, where I'm not writing a novel right this second. Rather, I need to write something every day, otherwise I'm not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I am. I'm taking a quotation of some important writer or figure or somebody who said something incredibly insightful in the past about writing, and then I'm adding a few comments to that. That's my blog. That's my writing. That's how I'm staying sane, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to be doing anything different for your second novel that basically you sort of learned from experience on this first one?
I can answer that so many ways. The first way is I do not want to self-publish my second novel.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of effort, time, they are always calling me, they are going to be doing this 60-second video trailer of my book,
mm-hmm.
An Albatross. They want me to have a blog. They want me to care about things I don't care about. Internet website, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I'm a writer, not a salesperson.
Oh, there's so many hats when you're a self-published author.
Yeah, and I can see that now. I am scheduling right now my publication date. I set it to be July 26th, 19th. This year, which is the same day in 1943 that the Army took over that Gulf.
Okay, wow. Mm-hmm.
I picked that publication date, Barnes & Noble, up the road from the golf course. Or the golf course, they both want me to do a book signing on that date, on those locations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of working this out and trying to figure out what to do next. You tell me and I'll do what you say.
Well, book signings are fantastic. I think that's great promotion. Sounds like fun. You'll get to meet some of your fans, too.
There you go. Thank you.
So any advice for other writers at this point as you've very much embarked on your new career?
Well, you know, you being a person who writes, I'm learning that you just have so much advice you want to give to writers that I try to temper that. And I slip back to the easiest, most obvious advice, which is write.
Mm-hmm.
You can say you're going to write. You can say you want to write, and someday will. But shoot, you could look back 10 years from now, and you haven't done anything but talk the whole time. That's the biggest lesson I've learned,
mm-hmm.
is write. Just do it right now. Just 10 sentences. Just write sentences. Write words. Write them to anybody. Keep a journal. Do that if you're going to truly pursue writing. That would be my advice. The other advice is, boy, stay in life. Don't, if you start writing, don't go overboard and just occupy your whole life with writing. You need to stay engaged with the family, with friends, not just with your mind, your world, and your, that boy, that's important.
Don't become a recluse.
Well, yeah, there's so much danger.
Yeah.
Withdrawal, stay connected with.
That's very, very good advice. So we mentioned your blog. Let's mention your website again. It's shootinganalbatross.com. And your book can actually be purchased through your website, Stephen?
Yes, it can. And I had something interesting happen a few days ago. Somebody, no, two somebodies, and they weren't my mother, actually pre-ordered the novel before it's even ready. It will ship in June. It should be ready to go in a couple weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
But I had two people order, and when I got that notice that somebody had actually pre-ordered my book, I didn't ask who at first, and I knew it wasn't my mother because she doesn't have a computer. I almost fell to my knees and go, oh, my gosh, what is happening? Emotionally, as a writer, you create these things, and people have said it's like having a baby that you just create it, and it takes off someday.
Oh, that's
I
so
think
exciting.
This novel's about ready to take off from me.
That is so exciting. That's so exciting, and this is just your first, and obviously you have many, many more to come. Do you have any long-term plans past this Albatross series?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Are you going to be going in different directions other than just fiction?
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might. There's something happening with this illness.
Mm-hmm.
I have an illness, and to get around, you know, I know I'm going to lose the ability to walk.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Shuta practically has, and I now use a Segway to get around. I call it a stand-up wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
Take it on airplanes, elevators, hotels, take it everywhere. And there is something happening that I see in the world around me that looks at me and how I react to that, seeing this person on a Segway, that I think is worth exploring.
Oh, interesting. So maybe kind of a nonfiction or a biography? Is that what you're saying?
Possibly. Possibly. It's there. These men. There are men. I'm back to this man thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting theme that will probably run through most of your writing, it sounds.
Yeah, they come up to me. And they tell me, you know, it used to be we'd stand there like men and just size each other up and who's the bigger, powerful, more powerful guy.
Right.
Well, now these big, powerful guys, everybody, they instantly, I'm no longer a threat. They win.
Mm.
And so they start telling me every interesting, not to me, but to them, telling me every insight in their lives, every problem they have with their wives, their health, their family, all the wonderful things, they open up as though I'm like their conscience or something. They just give to me everything they want, and I just listen. And I started to say not interesting. I turn my mind on and record these people just opening their hearts and just telling me everything.
How do you feel about that?
At first, I was really uncomfortable. I'm not used to a man exposing his heart to me.
Mm-hmm.
I get uncomfortable. I didn't have a dad, and so mm-hmm. I'm not used to it. It's like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You're not one of those kind of guys, are you?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm so used to it. It happens every single day. People just start telling me the most intimate details of their lives and their health.
There's
they
something safe
down
about
the
you.
Guard.
Yeah,
like I said, they win.
Yeah.
I can't walk.
You're not a threat, and there's something that just emanates from you now that just opens them up. Some
correct.
Sort of, yeah.
Correct.
That's so interesting. I imagine that experience and what you're going through surrounding that because of your illness will all make you just a better writer than you ever could have been.
I believe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's true. It's put me also on that. There's the stereotype that somebody who has an illness, maybe like a wheelchair or something, you don't see them. You being normal people who ambulate just fine, you tend to be less in the spotlight, and so you can do, and that's what serves me so well, is that I can do what I need to do, and that's see, observe, listen, watch, without anybody knowing I'm doing that. This illness just made it wonderful for that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I call this my illness is the perfect illness because one of the things you should do is sit around and do nothing.
Yeah, right.
Which I now can get away with sitting down and doing nothing for hours, but right.
But right.
Isn't
good
that
you.
Perfect?
You
That's
don't
what
have
I
to,
want.
Yeah. You didn't have to come up with an excuse. Your family must be so proud of you.
I'm proud of them, too.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, all the best with Shooting an Albatross. This really is an amazing first novel, and I know we will be hearing so much more coming from you in the coming years. So really, all the best, Stephen, and I want to thank you for coming and sharing your thoughts with us today.
Juanita, thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity, and thank you for having me on your program.
Absolutely. Did you have any just final words that you wanted to convey to your listeners?
I would convey, please sign on to shootinganalbatross.com. Get a copy of this book and get two of them because I think this is everybody on earth, their father should read this. This is a book for their father.
That's fantastic. All right, Stephen, you take care and all the best.
Thank you very much, Juanita.
All right, listeners, that's been Stephen Lundeen. His new book, Shooting an Albatross, is out now in pre-order, and probably as this interview is getting to you, is on shelves, so do check it out. Also, do check out Stephen's website, shootinganalbatross.com, and sign up for his blog, his blog alerts, his emails, and just really surf around on his website. He's got a lot up there. So I want to thank you for tuning in to this very interesting interview today on Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.